Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a photographer about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. This week, my guest is Victor Henning. Victor is the founder of Fjorden, an app company that make a grip that attaches to your iPhone to give you more camera-like control. So a shutter button that you can kind of half press and various dials and switches that you can use to manage your phone camera like you would a more traditional camera. Recently, the company was purchased by Leica, and they are now also responsible for the Leica Lux app, which is actually how I discovered Fjorden in the first place. We had a great conversation about old cameras, digital cameras, and the increasing performance and power of the camera in your pocket that led to him starting the company and where they might go next. So here's my conversation with Victor.
One of the things that people don't appreciate about Oslo is that you've got these little beaches, you know, dotted around. Mm. Really, really nice.
Yeah, no, beautiful. I haven't been, and it's on the list because I travel to like Sweden quite a lot for work, and I've been to Denmark a lot as a kid, and been to Holland, and so like I need to connect up like remaining countries, like, you know, do Germany and France, and in the UK you learn German and French at school, so there's kind of a natural overlap there, and you end up in Belgium at some point, so like there's a real gap there, so I do need to make my way at some point, and it might be a good place to travel with the family actually if there's that combination of town and kind of coastline and stuff. That'd be quite a good visit.
That's brilliant. I think, you know, we ourselves, we've been in Norway now for about 8 years, and we've actually not been further north than Ålesund, which is less than halfway up the country, so still lots and lots for us to explore. We had a camper van during the pandemic, so we traveled around a bit, and it's just such a stunning country and so many amazing places to see.
Yeah, I definitely have to do it. It's got to go onto the list. We're traveling to Greece again later this year, and I think I will make the case for sort of adding Oslo as a destination for like future visits. It'd be quite good as the kids get a bit older as nice. Well, I can travel about. I'd love a camper. What kind of camper van did you have?
It was a Weinsberg. It's a German brand. Mm. It's one of those converted Fiat Ducatos, you know.
Oh,
it had
yeah.
a high roof. Yeah. So I was sleeping in the roof, and my wife and daughter were sleeping in the bed in the back.
Fantastic.
It was nice, but still a bit noisy, you know.
Yes.
We rented a different one, I think it was last summer, which was like, you know, I'm not sure what they're called. I think partially integrated. So you've got that white box on the back instead of the original Ducato, like metal exterior.
Yeah.
And that's a bit more insulation, both in terms of temperature and of sound. And that was a bit more comfortable, but still, it was great, great fun. Wonderful adventure with the kid and a dog to just pull up in some, you know, parking lot by the beach, stay there for a day or two, and then travel on.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. Where we live in the Highlands in Scotland, there's lots of camper vans travel around, and you see lots of people coming over. We see a lot of German and Dutch number plates, like over the summer months, and the same with the motorbikes actually, like I think because there's good ferry connections, so you kind of get a lot of people coming over and sort of living their van life for the summer whilst they're in Scotland and doing the whiskey tours and sort of stopping by the side of the road because you can kind of got right to roam in Scotland, so you can kind of just stop anywhere.
I think it's quite similar in Norway, that it's overrun by German tourists in the summer. So I was quite glad that we had a, you know, I am German, but we had a Norwegian license plate, so nobody suspected us.
Oh, you can go incognito.
Yeah.
That went wrong for me once. I was in Romania and we had a rental car and they stopped us at a village and started speaking to us in Romanian. And then I was traveling with a bunch of Americans and Canadians, and we said, sorry, you know, we don't speak any Romanian really. And they said, okay. And they switched seamlessly into English and just went, in the next town, there is a virus. Don't stop, and wind up the windows. And we were like, okay, that's good.
That's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And there were people at either end of the town, armed police, just stood guard to stop people coming through. And they were hosing down vehicles as the vehicles kind of drove through the town. To kind of, I don't know, I don't know what they were protecting us from. It was presumably not too serious, but that will always stay with me. It was like something out of Resident Evil. You just drove
that sounds
through
more
this.
Like a zombie apocalypse.
Yes, that's exactly
or
what it felt
vampires,
like.
Or vampires, as it were, since it's Romania.
Well, Yeah, we did have that as well when we were near Transylvania, and we got invited down into a nightclub after a bar was closing. They said, we've got a club downstairs, and going in was like the beginning of Blade. And I just had this moment where I just thought, again, I'm very far from home. Is this a smart move? Actually, it was fine. Of course it's fine. It's always fine. But pre-pandemic, it seemed like a really weird experience. I guess post that experience, we all had this kind of weird shared moment where, like, now I think our... what's the word? Like, our expectation or our acceptance of the very unusual is maybe higher. You know, we maybe accept more than like previous generations would have done. But yeah, it's very strange. This is what I love about just hitting record and going. It's like Miles Davis, like start recording when people are in the car park. Because, you know, the podcast isn't really a podcast about photography. It's like Jaws isn't really about a shark. But yeah, so I guess when you're traveling light, and this is a seamless segue, hopefully, onto Lux and your kind of your professional photographic journey, I suppose, you're able to travel quite light with almost a professional camera kit in your bag now in the form of a phone and things. So talk to me and the listeners, I guess, to start us off about where your work on a camera app came from, why you thought there needed to be another one, and how you've arrived at what is clearly a really excellent one, you know, that deserves a place on phones. Like, talk me through that journey.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for the kind words. I think it's a question of how far back you want to go, really. I got some artifacts here on my desk.
Oh, cool.
So in the Kickstarter video, which introduced Fjorden, which is the company that I most recently built, maybe I'll start there. So yeah. I think you've alluded to Leica Lux, which is the app built by Leica, of which I'm now head of product. That came about because Leica acquired my company called Fjorden last December. So for those not familiar, Fjorden is a smartphone grip that you can attach to iPhones, and it gives you proper camera controls for the excellent little camera that you have in your iPhone. And of course, also has a corresponding app, which you need to make use of all of the hardware controls. So for example, the zoom lever, you can switch lenses. There's a clickable dial on top to, for example, switch from changing exposure compensation to ISO to shutter speed or film simulations. There's a dual stage shutter button, and there's a function button. And so that was the company that I built from, I think, starting in around the summer of 2000 until it was acquired by Leica, and it's ongoing. So we still make these and sell them, but in addition, now we're also making Leica Lux. Now, the reason I started talking about this, I guess, is because in the Kickstarter video for Fjorden, I was showcasing this little camera here, which is the Rollei 35 LED. And this is literally the first camera that I ever came into contact with. Because, so I was born in 1980, and my dad, I guess, has always been a camera and gadget nerd. So he had Super 8 cameras, and then at some point he brought home this one. And I immediately just fell in love with it, just the tactility of it. And like all the little sounds that it makes. Hold on, if I hold close to the microphone, you can probably hear, you know, the film winder, and that it's very satisfying, clicky sounds of everything. So as a kid, I was hooked. But then again, I didn't really get too involved with photography, probably for the next two decades of my life. I mean, I've always, you know, carried little point-and-shoot cameras, or sometimes even disposable cameras, which were, of course, more common in the 80s and 90s when I went on class trips and stuff. But the camera that really got me, I think, hooked on photography is one that I sadly don't have anymore. But I can maybe I can show you a photo somewhere, or you could, you know, later when you edit this, you could overlay a photo. it was the Pentax L C90, I think it was called. So that was a digital camera that came out in, I think, 1997. And again, it was one of the cameras that I inherited from my dad at some point. You know, whenever he upgraded to some other model, I got the old one. So this was the first digital one I got. And I got it in the summer of 2001. And it had a very unusual form factor in that the lens was sort of mounted not on the front of the camera, but sort of on the side of it. And there was an optical viewfinder at the back. and it had a modular detachable screen. So you could take off the screen and just have the smaller camera, carry that around with you, snap photos, and then later attach the screen again and review the photos you shot, or of course just take out the memory card. And what really hooked me was the immediacy of it. You know, of course, this was a new experience. Like, I dabbled with, you know, scanning photos and editing them on my computer in the 90s, just as, you know, as a weird hobby or joke with friends where you Photoshop yourself into like historical photos. You know, this was a novelty thing to do in the 90s, I guess. And there was a weird digression, but there was a website called, I think, Bert is Evil, you know, with a character, Bert from Ernie and Bert.
Yeah.
Photoshopped into historical events where he was like looking very sinister. So I was doing a similar thing as a joke. So I'd experimented a bit with scanning photos and thereby getting them digitalized. But having a camera where I could immediately get the digital file was so new and novel that I just started carrying it everywhere. And for me, what often happens, as I was thinking about, you know, this podcast and the concept of talk about three lenses that kind of have affected your photography or your photographic journey. And for me, when I thought about which ones they were, they're also always quite intimately connected to a certain place that I maybe got the lens or shot with it most. And so for me, this one, you know, I got this Pentax camera in the summer of 2001. And that summer, I went to California to work at my favorite record label as an intern.
Oh, wow.
The record label is called Revelation Records. It's a punk hardcore label. And it's based in Huntington Beach, California. So I stayed in a youth hostel right by the beach, by PCH, Pacific Coast Highway. And I would, carry this little camera everywhere to shows, to the beach, capturing also the people at the youth hostel. And this very particular Southern Californian light is what I remember.
Yeah.
And of course, the picture quality itself, you know, by modern standards was absolutely terrible. The resolution was, I think, around VGA, so like 0.4 megapixel, 768 by 540 maybe, somewhere around that. Very, very grainy, highlights always blown out.
Yeah.
But still, like, so much fun. The focal length, I looked this up yesterday, because I didn't know at the time, I didn't have any sort of knowledge about things like focal length or aperture. It was just like a camera and you could get the photo immediately. But I looked it up yesterday and the focal length was 50 millimeters. And when I used it, I realized one thing that it worked really well for was taking street photos because it was so stealthy. You know, like, it didn't look like a camera because of the very weird form factor. It looked like a silver brick with the lens, like I said, on the side, not on the front, like you normally have a camera. So you could walk across the street or stand at an intersection, just hold it in your hand without even looking through the viewfinder. Just point it at a scene, snap a photo. And then right after, you would see what you captured, which, you know, wasn't possible in my experience before with these, you know, point and shoot cameras and film cameras. And yeah, so that's the one that really, I think, got me hooked on photography. And I think after that, I can pretty much tell you and name every single camera I had, because that's when I started paying attention to, all right, okay, so what do I actually like about cameras? And I, you know, at first, had the typical, you know, novice photographer, again, not knowing anything about focal lengths or aperture or anything. I think my next upgrade was a slightly more modern Fujifilm point and shoot. And then I realized, oh, I kind of like having sort of an all-in-one lens. And I upgraded maybe just 1 or 2 years after. Now we're talking 2003 or so, to a Panasonic Lumix bridge camera, with like a massive, forgot the model number, but I think it was like FZ1000. FZ500, I think, with like a massive, probably, you know, 18 to 400 equivalent focal length, thereabouts. And I took that on travels as well. And that's when I started realizing, oh, wait, what is this thing where the background gets blurred when I do certain certain things with the camera? And so then my next upgrade was a Canon EOS 350D. So my first proper, quote unquote, digital camera. Mm-hmm. And that's what brings me, I guess, to the next lens that I really remember having a big impact on me as a photographer or my, photographic journey. Because when I bought the EOS, you know, 350D, I didn't buy it with a kit lens. I bought, I don't know why actually, but I bought the 50 millimeter EF 1.8.
Yes, I was hoping it was, as soon as you said that, I was like, nifty 50, be a nifty 50.
Exactly.
Ideally, the yes, oh, perfect. Yeah. Yes.
Again, and I had no idea that, you know, it was even called a nifty 50 or why that was like a focal length that was in any way special. And of course, with a crop factor, it was like a 75 millimeter. But that was my first contact with bokeh.
Yeah.
And like having blurred backgrounds. Yep. And again, on this theme of, you know, the place and time and the things that I photographed with it, I just moved to Weimar in Germany, where I started my PhD. And Weimar is a very, very beautiful town. So after the German reunification, it was massively restored with funds from the European Union. I think it was even the European Capital of Culture in 1999. So I arrived there in 2004 to start my PhD in social psychology, sort of decision-making research. So nothing to do with art per se, but I did it at Bauhaus University, where, of course, there was lots of creative people and like a big filmmaking scene. And yeah, so I got this nifty 50 and I started taking photos, and it was winter. So it was a lot like dark outside, and I had in my little apartment, I had some fairy lights. I experimented. I remember like the bokeh balls and the background blur. And then walking around outside, you have all of these monuments. There is lots of castles, and then there is, you know, Goethe and Schiller. And so their houses, Nietzsche's house, Franz Liszt. So all of these luminaries from German history, like, or German Enlightenment, if you will, Goethe, Schiller, Nietzsche, all the philosophers and the musicians, they all lived in Weimar either at the same time or successively. And not all of the houses are preserved or restored, and they're lit in the dark. So I was walking around, I was capturing all these scenes and experimenting with the bokeh. And yeah, that was a transformative experience. Like, just, having a proper camera and a proper lens to photograph with.
Yeah, the glass on the front makes such a big difference. Like, I made the transition to a proper, quote-unquote, proper camera probably a few years after you. I remember my first proper DSLR was a Nikon D40. That would have been about 2007. And again, it was that sudden difference, even with the kit lens that came with that. And then I very quickly got a 50 1.8. which was manual focus, which was because I messed up and I bought the wrong one, but I ended up quite liking manual focus, which I think is why I like my M system now, which is where I've landed. But it is that moment where you realize that actually the body has a lot less to do with it than the lens, and the sensor has a lot. Like, if you don't have good glass on the front, then you're sort of stuck in terms of like camera, you know, in camera you can get away with murder really, with like, if you've got really good glass on the front. And that difference, I remember thinking when I saw those 6 megapixel images from that crop sensor, just thinking, wow, like, I'm never gonna this is incredible, there can't be more detail resolved possibly than this, surely. And then obviously then, you know, someone shows you a full frame camera and then you're like, oh no, if you're predisposed to going down, you know, there's an arms race, like you have to get to the end. That's so cool. And running around at night, taking photos of those locations, it sounds like you did apply yourself to understanding how this tool worked, like the extreme ends. Cause a lot of people don't, shooting at night, especially in that era, my dad had a 350D. That was hard to do. Like, they were, you know, it was hard to get good results in those sort of settings. You had to really think about it.
Yeah, I mean, this lens made it seem so easy because obviously it captured so much more light than all of the cameras and lenses I'd used before. And of course, the sensor was bigger. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call myself a serious student, though. I was still very much just, you know, amateur photographer, hobbyist, carrying it with me. Also realizing for the first time that maybe this, you know, ultimately the 75 millimeter equivalent wasn't that suitable for shooting a lot of the say, you know, parties that I was at, or I was often at dinners with my doctoral thesis advisor. And then, of course, you realize, okay, this focal length is too long, and you start thinking about, okay, what else, you know, might I want or might I need? And I guess I experimented a lot as well with zoom lenses versus primes. And I think for a while, I mostly went with zoom lenses until I realized that for me, the image quality that I was looking for, the bokeh, just wasn't quite there.
Yeah.
The feel of it wasn't quite there. But I guess it took me quite a while and quite a journey over many years to really come to that realization where I'm back to using exclusively primes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a sort of 10-year process or longer of, you know, again, not being a serious photography student, just kind of a hobby photographer with gear acquisition syndrome. So switching cameras very, very frequently and regularly.
Yeah.
But yeah, also this realization that ultimately it's the glass that matters. That one, I think, came fairly early on in the journey where, in fact, you know, as you said, you can get away with a pretty bad camera body if the lens is good.
Yeah.
And my PhD advisor at the time was also getting interested in digital photography because we were organizing these events with filmmakers, actually, since, you know, both of us were film freaks, film nuts.
Yeah.
And the area of study that we chose in our field, so it was a chair of marketing. And my PhD, like I said, was sort of on the intersection of consumer behavior and social psychology.
Right.
But the area of study that we chose to test our theories was usually film and film distribution, film marketing, that kind of thing. And so we organized a lecture series where we had film producers, directors come to Weimar and give talks to our students. And then it would be usually me taking photos. And then he also wanted to do it. And was like, okay, what should I do? What camera should I get? And I was like, yeah, it's not so much about the camera. It's the lens that you want to pay close attention to, right? But yeah, I would still say that at the time, still had a very, very rudimentary understanding of those things. But, you know, gradually getting there over the next decade or so.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been at this maybe 18 years trying to be good at making pictures, and I feel like I'm closer than I've ever been, but I'm not done. You know, there are still moments where I miss it, or there are still moments where I think back in my composition. I think if you can be forever amateur, that's probably a good place to be, you know, always open to kind of trying new things and mixing it up. Because that was a period for listeners who are not, because we were about the same age, for listeners who are not like growing up through that period, and you didn't have phones with cameras in, people, I remember having my DSLR and even a small DSLR, people being surprised when it came out of a bag and it was like, oh, it's a camera. You know, there was a moment of, this isn't an Ixus point and shoot Canon type thing.
Those were everywhere, the Ixus.
They were.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one of those.
They're very, very distinct aesthetic as well. Like if you went to a party afterwards, there were always the Ixus shots and they all looked the same, right? Like this.
Yeah.
The flash combined with the long exposure, so you would have this very warm orangey background, but then the subject was like brightly lit. I remember that aesthetic so well.
Yeah, well, it's been coming back, hasn't it, recently, the digicam craze that I think makes Leica look smart for having a Deluxe 8 in the lineup, you know, when everyone else is moving away from these small cameras. And you know, that it's, I mean, theirs is more premium, I guess, but that idea of a small, convenient, everyday carry kind of camera, you know, my stepdad, famous stepdad Chris of podcast fame, he's just got a CL for the same reason. Wants something small and light, L mounts perfect, stick it in your bag, take it everywhere. And then he's got bigger cameras if you want to take them. So I think that there's an interest in that kind of thing and also the aesthetic that comes with them, because heaven knows film is so expensive now. And it's fun to play with, but it gets expensive real quick. What do you ever dabble in film?
No, actually, never.
Just fully.
I've always been, you know, ever since that Pentax stayed on digital. Never went back to film. Sadly, maybe because I'm sure I've missed out on a lot of great experience and learning moments. Interestingly, our CTO Florian, his grandfather had like a film lab in his basement. And so Florian had a lot of exposure to that process as a kid. But I think he also just shoots digital. But on the Fjorden/Leica Lux team, we do have a lot of film photographers as well.
Yeah. Well, that's quite interesting. So do you find that like the, when you're all bringing, because you're all, we are all in it, when you work in a creative industry, like I work in video games, like even if you're not day-to-day working on the thing, you bring that experience of those things and what good looks like to you. Do you think that those mixed, that mixed set of mediums and sources and journeys kind of feeds into the app as you make it? Because I think a lot of people would think that a camera app is a solved problem at this point. And I think the fact that you are a team of like people who've arrived on a different creative paths probably feeds in and probably makes the thing richer. Like, was that by design that you brought people in with different backgrounds like that? Or have you just discovered it as people have come in?
It's probably a mix of both. I mean, of course, when we put out job ads for, you know, working on a team like ours, you attract people that are interested in photography, and then many of those are into film. But yeah, we did look at CVs, and if somebody was shooting film, we're like, oh, that's interesting. We'd love to get somebody like that who has that experience of working with film, and like, oh, very often they also shoot on, you know, purely manual cameras. Yeah. So that was something that we did look for. But I think, you know, coming back to what you said earlier, this this trend towards smaller, lighter point-and-shoot cameras, I think that was also what ultimately led me down to, you know, starting Fjorden in the first place. Because so after the 350D, I sort of went one step up in size. I mean, still APS-C, but I think my next camera was the Canon 70D. But I think after that, I was like, oh my, these are just getting big and heavy, and I just wanted something smaller to carry around, right? And I think now we're in 2013 or so. Mm-hmm. So like I probably had the 350D for a couple of years and then the 70D for a couple of years. But then in 2013, that was when the Fujifilm X-E1 was released. Mm. And I was immediately drawn to the aesthetic and that rangefinder style. Couldn't afford a Leica, of course. You know, I was a startup founder at that time. Hadn't sold my company yet. But I was drawn to the X-E1. Sold all my Canon gear, bought the X-E1. Again, with what turned out to be a Nifty 50. So it was the Fujifilm 35mm 1.4, which at the crop factor is the 50.
Yeah.
And I just loved the look of that lens. And the only thing that bugged me, though, was how super slow the focus was on the X-E1 compared to the Canon cameras that I had before. Right. And I think that set me off on a search where I just tried many, many different camera bodies and form factors. So I then tried the X100T, found it at the time like too restrictive to only have the 35mm equivalent lens, which anyway, like, you know, having also experimented with 35mm lenses, is not a focal length that somehow works for me. It's either wider or closer for some reason. Then I tried the Lumix LX100, which is, of course, you know, the cousin of the Deluxe 7, Deluxe 8. And that was probably my go-to camera for many years because it was so small and pocketable. I really loved the look that it produced. Beautiful colors, beautiful image rendering. And the only reason that I think I sold it at some point was had this problem of sucking dust into the lens when it collapsed. And even though I had it serviced, it didn't improve. And then I think ended up at the Panasonic GX9. So again, the sort of rangefinder style camera, Micro Four Thirds though, because I'd seen some photographers that I knew rave about the Olympus Micro Four Thirds cameras. And so I tried the GX9, absolutely loved the form factor, loved the tiltable viewfinder, loved many of the lenses because obviously they were so small and light and pocketable. But with the GX9, I think it was a problem of sensor noise for me.
Right.
Even though in the tests, if you look at, you know, DP Review and others, it always did super well. But in my photos, for whatever, maybe I had a lemon model, I don't know if that's possible. But for me, it always was super, super noisy, like lots of chroma noise.
Right.
But I was still stuck with the Micro Four Thirds. and I added a Pen-F at some point, which then became my go-to model. And I really loved that one. And then I think around 2016 or so, I got full frame fever and I thought, no, I have to have a full frame camera. Got to try it. I never had one.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was 2017. I'm not sure. Like it was the EOS RP1. So the, you know, the entry level Canon full frame model.
Yeah.
So I quote unquote upgraded to that one together with the 35mm when I realized, okay, 35 is not my focal length. But I think that brings us to around 2017, 2018, when the next camera that really changed things for me came around. It's this one here.
There we go.
This is the Huawei P30 Pro.
Yeah.
And so I had become a father in 2014. And like all parents, I guess, you know, constantly take pictures of your kids. Probably like, you know, nearly everything in my film roll was just my daughter. But of course, I never had my cameras with me. I always had my phone in my pocket. And I guess we all had that experience where we all carried our phones and the cameras got better and better. And so maybe like a bigger proportion of our photos became mobile phone photos. And I deliberately had switched from iPhone to the Huawei one because of the collaboration with Leica. I had seen some reviews and some sample photos of the image quality of the computational photography, you know, that Huawei had co-engineered with Leica, both the color profiles, the looks, and the computational bokeh was just, oh, wow, I got to try that. And I think I got the P20 Pro first and then the P30 Pro when it came out in 2018, 2019. And I moved to Norway just, you know, the year before that, 2016. And again, like in terms of the location, we lived in this house by the fjord and the light over the fjord was always changing. You would have, on some days you'd have the fog rising from the fjord and then you'd have these cruise ships that were coming in and out of the fjord all the time and they would light up that fog as they were cruising through it. And the light anyway in the winter in Norway is really, really special. It's, I mean, sadly, I guess it's due to air pollution, right? You get that, especially with cruise ships. And that is a problem in and around Oslo, which is why they're cutting down the number of cruise ships. Like the sulfur particles in the air, they give you a lot of color.
Right.
So as sad as it is that it's due to pollution, just visually, it was always stunning to have these very, very purple sunsets with that light coming in just over the mountains.
Wow.
Onto the fjord very often. Then you have the fog drifting up from the fjord and into the forest on the other side. And then you've got these cruise ships drifting through with their lights on. Just amazing. And then, of course, outside you've got snow in the winter.
Yeah.
And I use the P20 Pro a lot to take photos of my daughter. And very often I would use the portrait mode. And I mean, as today, the object segmentation, the foreground and background didn't work properly. You've got like right now, as in our video, right? The tips of the hair get blurred out and they shouldn't be, or the ear gets lost or whatever. So same problem then as today. But when it worked, man, was that amazing. Like to suddenly have this ability to take photos that seemed indistinguishable from a great portrait photo in something that you have in your pocket. And it was mostly also at the 27mm focal length. So these had the 27mm, I think they're called Vario Summilux lenses, co-engineered with Leica. And then the Huawei and Leica co-engineered computational bokeh. And that blew my mind, that you could have images like these coming out of a phone where I was friends with a photographer at the time, and I showed him some photos and he was like, that's on a phone? That's insane. That's not possible. Like he couldn't tell.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think that's when I thought, I love the image quality that I can get from these phones. What I miss though is the fun and the joy and the experience of just holding a really well-designed object.
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, I have a Leica here in my hand or take this one, any camera really.
Yeah.
I think for me, cameras have always been as much about the aesthetics and the fun and the joy of holding them and interacting with them. Like I said, since I was a kid, just the tactility of the experience of using a camera, just looking through the viewfinder as much as taking the photo.
Yeah.
And so I felt that experience was missing for me when taking photos on the smartphone. As great as it was, it just wasn't as much fun, and it didn't feel as though I had enough control over the process, because it was a touch screen and the form factor was awkward. So you kind of end up holding it, at least I hold it, kind of like this.
Yeah.
And then you're swiping over the screen with your thumb. And by the time you're trying to adjust something, whether it's exposure, whether it's aperture, of course you can do it in post as well many times. But if you're trying to nail a shot first time or switch lenses even, then you have to swipe and you miss where you're supposed to swipe. Or it's Norway, so we wear gloves for half the year, so it doesn't really work that well with gloves anyways.
Yeah.
So many shots that I felt that I missed, and I thought, there should be something that I can attach to my smartphone that gives me proper camera controls, like physical camera controls, and I can combine that with the computational photography. That would be the dream.
Yeah.
And so I literally bought every single one of these, you know, smartphone attachments that were out on the market at the time, and I tried them all. Ergonomically, some were better than others, but the one thing they all had in common is that they only had a shutter button. So they were essentially selfie sticks in a different form factor. So no other controls, no zoom lever, no dial, no function button that I could assign functions to. And I, you know, famous last words, it's got to be possible to do that better, you know, like I guess as a startup founder. So, you know, I had previously founded a software company that I built from 2008 to 2013 in a different field. It was a tool for scientists to collaborate and share their research. But so that gave me some knowledge, of course, about how to build companies, how to build software companies in particular. I had no idea about building hardware or hardware companies, but I figured, again, famous last words, how difficult could it be? Turns out, very, very difficult and super painful. And especially if you're trying to do it during a pandemic where factories in China randomly get shut down and all of the distribution and all of the logistics from Asia to Europe were disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So huge learning curve, very, very painful process. But anyway, that's why I started Fjorden. You know, it was the... The journey from always carrying those big cameras to buying smaller and smaller cameras, because as a gadget nerd, I like small things. And as a photographer, I want something that I can have with me all the time. And the lack of tactile controls. And that was ultimately what, you know, gave me the idea for this thing.
Which is a fantastic thing to exist. And I love your observation that I really like to meet people who are founders and who've made things, because there is, I used to work in open source software, and what was great about working on Ubuntu was that if something bothered you, you could change it. And I like to meet people who can scratch their own itch like that. Can see they don't just live with the way things are. They see something that they see as just deficient in some way, and they cannot imagine how it does not drive everyone else insane. And I can imagine, until the day you open the first box of these prototypes that work and you can start to see this, things really, oh, thank goodness, like the itch is going away because I need this thing to exist, you know, like through that whole period. So I love the observation around the buttons, especially because it's such an obvious thing. Like a lot of people, you put it in their hand, they go, oh yeah, that's nice. But the fact that you've gone to the trouble of recreating the most commonly used controls for a user, I think is wonderful. And then how did that then transition? So you needed an app, I guess, to drive the functions. Were you always going to build the camera functionality and the film simulations and things in, or were you only initially interested in the grip, and did scope creep take over? Or was it very fully formed in your mind?
Yeah, it's a good question, because initially I had this idea that I could build the hardware only and figure out a way that I could maybe use accessibility controls built into phones to use the hardware to control the native camera apps, because I figured I wanted to do this for iOS and Android. I knew that building a camera app on iOS was probably feasible, since others had done it. Mm. I knew that on Android it would be much, much harder because of the fragmentation of the Android ecosystem, the way that every manufacturer has different lens setup, different way of running controls, of exposing controls maybe to developers, which is also why there's probably, at least none that I'm aware, great third-party camera apps on Android, whereas, of course, many, many exist on iOS. So at first I wanted to avoid this, and I thought, okay, maybe I could use, for example, on Android, I've forgotten now what it's called, not assistive touch, but I thought there might be ways that I could map out where on the screen, depending on which phone you were using, say you're using a Samsung phone, where on the screen is the shutter button, where is the slider for exposure compensation, where is the mode switch button. And I figured maybe I could crowdsource this information from Android users to make sure that my interface would work across manufacturers. Because, again, taking a step back with my previous company, Mendeley, the idea was crowdsourcing scientific information. Yeah. And that worked so well that in a span of 3 to 4 years, we built the world's largest scientific database by building software that people could install in their computer and would ingest all of the PDFs, the research papers that you'd stored on your computer. We would extract the metadata anonymously, pool it, and deduplicate, and then build real-time trend information across different scientific fields and enable people to share and collaborate. So this idea of crowdsourcing was big in my mind. Yeah. And I thought I could do the same for building camera controls across devices. Turned out that wasn't feasible at all, at least not if I wanted to have a good user experience. And also on iOS, I just couldn't figure out a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. And so very early on in the process, I realized, okay, I'm going to have to focus on iOS only and build my own camera app. And at first, had sort of an outsourced prototype built by a couple of freelancers. But as soon as I had a working prototype of the Fjorden Grip, and I realized, okay, this is going to work, at least the way I imagine it's going to work, I started looking for a teammate, or essentially a co-founder / CTO, who could build the app from scratch. And that's how I found Florian, which is a funny story as well, because I had been searching everywhere, of course, LinkedIn and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And then the way I found Florian was that he had liked a photo that I posted on Twitter. Huh. And I was like, oh, who's this guy? iOS developer. Clicked on his website, lots of photos that he'd posted from his travels. And I realized he was shooting both with an iPhone and with, I think at the time, Olympus cameras. So I reached out to him and said, hey, do you want to build a camera app? And we just immediately hit it off. And he's been basically with Fjorden and helped create Fjorden with me. And
amazing.
Yeah, that's been our journey.
Oh, amazing stuff. And then how does a conversation with Leica come about? Because I think when Lux launched, which is what prompted me to get in touch with you, like I joke about this a lot, that the podcast is in danger of becoming a Leica and Polaroid podcast. But I make no apologies for it. They're the two cameras I use the most. So unfortunately, that's, if people are annoyed already, next week will be worse because I'm interviewing Steph and Daniel. So that's going to get even, it's going to get even more complicated. But anyway, how does that come about? Were they on the hunt for something? I'm assuming that it's a little bit like your LinkedIn search. They were maybe looking around that this was an area they saw an opportunity to be in and get the brand into.
Yeah, it was both. So I originally reached out to them through LinkedIn, and not knowing who it was that I was supposed to talk to, because I didn't have any contacts at Leica. I just pinged probably 10 people simultaneously who all had titles that sounded like they might be a good person to talk to. Uh-huh. And my reason for reaching out was that I figured at this point, we'd managed to build something that worked really well on iOS, and there was still that original idea of bringing it to Android. Mm. And of course, by now, Leica had this collaboration with Xiaomi since, the Trump ban, essentially Huawei disappeared from the market in the West.
Yeah.
So Leica was now at this point working with Xiaomi, you know, by now, I think the largest Android manufacturer, as well as having their own line of Android phones, which to date is only available in Japan, the Lights phone. But I figured, hey, maybe this is a way to bring Fjorden to Android together with Leica, which of course, for me, Leica has always been the brand that I admired most. And when we did the industrial design for the Fjorden grip, we had Leica cameras and looked at them and lots of these rangefinder style cameras and then tried to take inspiration from the control layout, the overall aesthetic, etc. And I guess Leica is just the brand that as a photographer, at least I had always looked up to the most. So I reached out to them, 10 people simultaneously. And one of them got back to me pretty quickly, Marius. Mm-hmm. And he told me, he was in the office and he said, oh, look, it's the Fjorden guys. They reached out to me. Oh, to you as well? Because it pinged up at several people's screens at the same time.
Yeah.
So we then met up in Wetzlar, the town where Leica is headquartered, went out for a pizza in the Dome Square in a little cobblestone streets, old town in the center of Wetzlar, really picturesque. Had a pizza and just generally talked about our respective product roadmaps and visions. And so Leica had been looking for a way to deliver a better camera experience for their users on mobile. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that 90%+ of Leica photographers use iPhone.
Right.
So they're not on Android. Most Leica users are on iOS. Yep. And so rather than the conversation being, how do we bring something like Fjorden to Android? It was more like, could we help Leica bring a great camera experience to iOS? Because we'd built a camera app already. Mm-hmm. We had some experience with hardware and also like on a personal level, you know, Florian and myself both being German, I think there's a very particular German sense of humor that it does exist, despite rumors to the contrary. So we just immediately got along as well on a personal level and started talking about how we could make this happen. And then over the course of the next month or two, as we kept talking, it became pretty obvious that the best way to make it happen was for Leica to buy us. So that we could focus on this without having sort of conflicts of interests down the road.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. I mean, if you're up for that, what an amazing way to kind of join forces with a brand that you've admired and make great images. I will say I'm using the app daily because I've mapped it to the action button on my phone.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
I launch. So you're until they replace the camera, because I think the next version of iOS, they're going to let us change the mapping of the camera button on the front as well. But right now, that physical, that tactility, I haven't gone for the grip yet, but I have created some of that for myself in just using the action button to launch the camera, because there is a care and attention, and a, you know, part of the reason I use a Leica at all is for the colors and the tactility, but mostly it's there is a laziness aspect to it. Like, I want the images to look a certain way. I don't want to have to post-process every image. I know that any modern camera can be made to look like just about any modern camera, but I enjoy these tools. I really love using them, and there is the added byproduct of I feel like I don't have to do much to the image afterwards. And so the app is great for that, because it creates that in that quick, like, I don't want to have to get my rush and find my M every time a child does something or there's a squirrel on a bird table or, you know, something like that, you know? So, it's tremendous. Like, I really, from day one, really enjoyed using it. I think the film simulation, I'll just embarrass you for a moment, but like the film simulations are wonderful, especially the black and white, because I think the black and white's harder than people think, isn't it? Like, it's tougher to get right.
Yeah, this is the part that Leica contributed. So the way the app is built is a collaboration between the existing Fjorden team, and we're now also hiring more developers. But they're sort of, you know, within the Fjorden structure, if you will. So it's still Florian and me running the team, and we're building the Lux app. But the whole image processing pipeline is made by Leica image processing engineers. So they're building both the algorithms for the bokeh simulations for the different Leica lenses that we're trying to recreate in the app.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there's a long history of Leica doing this, first with with Huawei, then Xiaomi, and with the Lights phone. But of course, now bringing that to iOS required some additional engineering, but also all of the color processing is done by the team at Leica, and we basically plug and play that into the iOS app that the Fjorden team builds. And so, I mean, we're all one big team, really, you know, all in the same Slack channel. We meet up regularly, like right now, there was a, just yesterday, design workshop in Zagreb. Before the summer, there was a get together for the whole business unit mobile, of which Fjorden is a part. And yeah, it's nice to work with these guys.
Yeah, it's tremendous. Are you a remote team then? Like, or do you have like a central HQ? How do you structure yourselves?
Yeah, we're, the Fjorden side is completely remote, owing to the fact that we were started during the pandemic.
Of course.
Which had many, many strange stories coming out of it, I guess. So for example, when we did the industrial design for the Fjorden grip, the industrial design office that I worked with, they were in Oslo. So I just have to take the ferry and I'm in town and I could meet them. But so initially when we met, we often had our meetings on the roof terrace of their office in order to be outside. And it's Norway, it's cold. And then you're sitting there, you know, in the winter shivering, just trying to feel anything in your fingers. And then trying to compare like 20 different 3D prints to figure out which of the various form factors you like most and which sits best in the hand. But yeah, also then thereafter, once we started hiring the team, Florian was in Amsterdam. Our next team member who we hired coincidentally also was in the Netherlands, but in Utrecht. So about, you know, half an hour down the road from Amsterdam. And then I think our designer at the time was based in Romania. Our operations team is in the Philippines. And since then, we've hired more team members in Italy, now Greece and Denmark.
Wow. You're filling out that map. You're going to have like little pins on a, on it. That's so cool. That's really, really great. I was going to ask about 3D printing as well and rapid prototyping, because I've worked a little bit in manufacturing and that changes the game. Like not having to wait for things to go away, like, you know, being able to get on a ferry and go and test different things, stand next to an object or something like that and just see your different options come out. That's quite good.
So much fun. So much fun just to, I think, you know, whereas my whole experience so far as an entrepreneur had been software. And not that I'm coding anything myself. Like, I built a couple of websites in the early 2000s, but that was the extent of my coding knowledge. So having something tactile that you dream up and then somebody, you know, makes a CAD model and prints it out and you can interact with it. That was so enjoyable. I mean, initially, the very first prototype ideas for the Fjorden grip, I had just made out of cardboard, just so I could figure out, okay, how would this even feel having something stuck to the front of the phone? But of course, those looked nothing like the final products. But then having all of those different form factors to play with. And then as the next step, of course, once we had some PCBs and were able to stick them inside and take the first photo over Bluetooth, like triggering the camera, that was one of those, it's alive moments.
Yes. It's really cool. I don't know if you've heard, there was a story when the Palm Pilot was first being invented. The engineers working on that before, again, before they had a thing, cut a piece of wood to be about the shape of a Palm Pilot that they thought, and they, to work out, basically what they were trying to work out pre-massive smartphones in our pockets was to work out what was the biggest you could go. Like, how big can this thing be? Probably in terms of, can we fit these types of batteries in or another type of battery and things like that? But also just how big can the screen be? You know, can it be the size? Can it actually be the size of a notebook, or is that too large in your trouser pocket? And, you know, working all the, all sorts of those things out as well. It's quite fun. It's an addicting thing though, isn't it? Living in that kind of world of possibility before, because 3D printers are amazing. But in my previous role, when I worked with them, they made things feel very real, very quickly. And we were dealing with another German company, Roche, and I think they would come and see a 3D printed prototype and maybe some metal prototype pieces, and then they'd suddenly go, oh cool, it's done then. And you'd be like, no, none of this is real, this is just, this is an illusion, we don't have PCBs yet, we don't have, you know, like all those things. So no, it's a very cool thing to be able to work with. So what's the plan from here on then? Do you guys continue to, you know, you've got effectively you've got film simulations. They're not quite film simulations, not film stock, but they, you've got the lens simulations, which are also tremendous in this. Like, I have a couple of the lenses and seeing them side by side, you know, you've achieved the magic of, like, it tricks you into thinking it's the real thing. It's amazing. Like, what's the roadmap? I mean, you've got, you're hiring, you're doing all the stuff. Can you talk about any of the stuff you're doing, or is it kind of watch this space?
So this is where, you know, previously as a founder, I was always super open talking about roadmaps and things I wanted to do.
It's not your roadmap now.
No, I mean, it is to some degree, but at the first press tour for Lux, the Leica press guys took me aside and were like, don't promise anything. You know, just don't promise anything, because you never know what's going to change. Yeah. I will say this much. So we definitely have several more things in the pipeline that we want to build, just on the camera side. But of course, if you think about Leica, there is way more that's part of this brand, right? And the brand experience of Leica. There is LFI magazine, there is Leica galleries, there's Leica Academy. There is this whole vibrant community around Leica. And we would like to find a way to get those people into the app and let them experience and be part of, you know, experience what it feels like to be part of the Leica community. Unfortunately, I also now have to run because I'm off to another meeting.
That'll stop me
from, like, giving away too much at this point anyway. But that's what we would like to do.
Amazing. Well, that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really, really appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
All right. Take care, mate. Have a good day. See you soon.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Victor, for fitting me in between meetings. I'm quite sure that you were going to let slip something very exciting before you got pulled away there. If you've enjoyed the episode, then don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere that you listen to your podcasts. Tell a friend, get them to come on over. Drop me a line, send me a DM, do something. I love to hear from listeners. It's great to engage with the community we're building around this thing. If you don't already, you can also sign up to the weekly newsletter, which is available on ianfarrell.com/sign-up. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. And as I mentioned in this interview, next week's quite a good one. I'm talking to Stefan Daniel of Leica Camera. He's in charge of all of Leica Camera, the sport optics, everything, the whole deal. We spoke the day before the M11D was announced, and whilst the Q343 was a twinkle in everybody's eye. So I'm going to have to get him back at some point and talk about those. So don't forget to tune in for next week. But in the meantime, have a fantastic week, and we'll see you next time.